I'd like to go ahead and call the meeting of the Senate State Affairs Committee to order. Let the record reflect it's just after 3:30 p.m. We are in the Belts Committee Room in Juneau, Alaska. Present today are Senator Wilikowski, Senator Merrick, Senator Bjorkman, Senator Klayman will be on his way shortly, and myself, Chair Kawasaki. We do have a quorum to conduct business. On today's agenda, we have a couple bills. Senate Bill 193, Sexual Assault Examination Kits and Tracking. That is sponsored by, let's see, we do not have that, I'm sorry. We have Senate Bill 208, Vehicle Register Transfer on Death, sponsored by Representative Rauscher. House Bill 316, Emergency Wireless Device Location, sponsored by Representative Craig Johnson. We have a second hearing on Senate Bill 193, Sexual Assault Examination Kits Tracking Rules by Request of the Governor. It's a second hearing, I'm sorry, a first hearing on Senate Bill 229, the Gun Violence Protective Orders. And so first up, we will go ahead and take up Senate Bill 193, Sexual Assault Examination Kits Slash Tracking, which is sponsored by Rules by Request of the Governor. And we have a draft committee substitute of Senate Bill 193 in your packets. May I have a motion, Senator Merrick?
Thank you, Chair Kawasaki. I move to adopt the committee substitute for Senate Bill 193, Work Draft 33-GS2317, /Bravo as our working document.
Great. And I'll go ahead and object for purposes of discussion. And I have staff, Joe Hayes, to discuss the differences in version B of the bill.
Deputy Chairs, Senator Kawasaki, Joe Hayes, staff to you. Senator Kawasaki, committee members, I'll go through some of the changes from version A 193 to version B. So section 1 adds a new subsection 1 and renumbers the subsequent sections. Section 1 on page 1, following line 3 of the version, amends the statute to add a new section to the Crime Victims' Rights Statute to include the right to be notified of the location and testing date of the sexual assault examination kit collected from the victim. Section 2, page 3, line 4, requires law enforcement to send a sexual assault examination kit to an accredited laboratory with DPS within 20 days of receiving the notice from the healthcare provider, reducing the current time frame from 30 days. Page 3, line 22, requires the laboratory receiving the completed sexual assault examination kit to complete the DNA tests on a kit within 120 days, reducing the current time frame of 6 months. And page 3, line 26, changes from 17 to 14 days for healthcare providers to gather information and notify appropriate law enforcement agencies that the sexual assault kits are available to be sent to the accredited laboratory operated by the Department of Public Safety.
Thank you for that brief introduction. I just wanted to note that Senator Klayman, Vice Chair, is here. Do we have any questions before we accept the committee substitute as our working document? Okay, hearing none, the committee substitute for Senate Bill 193, that is Work Draft 33-GS2317 /B, is our working document. I'll remove my objection. I'm going to take a brief at ease. Okay, I call the meeting of the Senate State Affairs Committee back to order. We do have David Canaris at the Forensic Science Lab. He's the chief, Alaska State Crime Lab. He's here for questions only online. Are there any questions for Mr. Canaris? Okay, hearing and seeing none, we'll go ahead and open up public testimony. on Senate Bill 193. And is there anybody in the room like to testify on Senate Bill 193? Maybe there is. Yes, we do have one person. If you'd like to come before us, state your name and affiliation for the record. Welcome.
Hello, hello, Brenda Stanfield. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. I didn't know this bill was going to be heard today, so I didn't prepare anything very, very formally. I do apologize for that. That was my error, and we're jumping between House Finance and Senate State Affairs today. But we do strongly support this bill. One of the worst things that can happen in a woman's life other than being murdered, I believe, is raped. It's life-changing. You never go back. And this bill puts some control in the hands of the victims to be able to know where their kit is at any time. And it also starts bringing our investigation times into a relatively time frame that is getting closer to CSI, but not quite, you know, that hour long. But down to 4 months is incredible to in our crime lab, and they've made great strides to bring down the time frames. We also have looked at that time for the nurses to turn in. We think 14 days is a little broad, but we also understand that there has been testimony saying that they would like to make sure that there's a time given to them to adequately do their paperwork, and so we understand that change in giving them the 14 days. So we strongly support, and we really appreciate the addition to adding this into the victims' rights. So thank you very much for your time today and for your hearing of this bill.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Stanfield. Are there any questions? Hearing and seeing none, and hearing and seeing no other testimony, we'll go ahead and close public testimony. We're going to get back to the committee. Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Kawasaki. I move committee substitute for Senate Bill 193, Work Draft 33-GS2317/Bravo, reported out of committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Are there any objections? Okay, hearing and seeing none, committee substitute for Senate Bill 193, that is Work Draft 33-GS2317/B, is reported out of the committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note, and we will take a brief at ease. Okay, I'd like to call the Senate State Affairs Committee meeting back to order. We are now on Senate Bill 208. Senate Bill 208 was heard a couple times in different forms, but it is vehicle register transfer insurance license. We have had, this is the third hearing. We do have a committee substitute available in the packet. May I have a motion to adopt the committee substitute? Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Kawasaki. I move to adopt the committee substitute for Senate Bill 208, Work Draft 33-GS2373/Bravo as our working document.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. If we could have Mr. Hayes come up briefly and exchange and explain the brief changes to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the committee, Joe Hayes, staff to Senator Kawasaki. Pretty much the changes starts on page 3, lines 4, where we add the mobile electronic devices. Then on page 4, lines 20, we put a cap space for a driver should carry a physical electronic certification or registration of vehicle. Page 8, we add in section 2815.131, we add electronic. Page 9, lines 24 through 26, we put a definition, every application for an electronic driver's license or permit and the electronic driver's license permits issued by the department. Page 12, sections 37, 28, 15, 271, we add new fees for licenses and registrations and a new fee for electronic driver's license or permit. Page 13, we put safeguards in a peace officer or other authorized representatives of the Department of Public Safety presented proof of motor vehicle liability insurance on a mobile electronic device shall promptly return to the device to the person once the peace officer or representative verifies that the person possessing proof of motor vehicle liability insurance. And on page 16, section 49, it says a person's display of electronic certificate or registration of a mobile electronic device under this subsection does not constitute consent for a peace officer or officer or employee of the department to access other contents of the mobile electronic device. A peace officer presented with a mobile electronic device under this subsection is immune from liability resulting from damage to the device, except that a peace officer may be liable for civil damages as a result of peace officer's intentional misconduct. And pretty much, Mr. Chair, that's the changes, adding an electronic driver's license.
Great, thank you, Mr. Hayes. Are there any other comments to make on the committee substitute? Hearing none, I'll withdraw my objection. Are there any further objections to adopting the committee substitute as our work draft? Okay, hearing none, committee substitute for Senate Bill 208, work draft 33-GS2373/B's. Our work draft. We now have the bill back before us. It is going to go on finally to Senator Merrick in Finance. Are there any further questions or comments to make on the bill before Senator Merrick?
Thank you, Chair Kawasaki. I move committee substitute for Senate Bill 208, work draft 33-GS2373/Bravo, be reported out of committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Are there any objections? Hearing and seeing none, committee substitute for Senate Bill 208, work draft 33-GS2373/B is reported out of committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal notes, and we'll take a brief at ease. Like to call the meeting of the Senate State Affairs Committee back to order. Before us, we now have a House bill, House Bill 316, Emergency Wireless Device Location. We have the sponsor and his staff person, Representative Craig Johnson. And Portia, if you'd like to come to the table, and if you could state your name and affiliation for the record, welcome to the Senate State Affairs Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Craig Johnson, House District 10. Thank you for hearing this today. And with me is
Portia Samuels, staff to Representative Johnson. Thank
you. It doesn't appear that we have the invited testimonies and communications, so, but I think we can at least fill you in on what the invited testimony would say. HB3, may I proceed, sir?
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. HB 316 is about helping victims and saving lives. It codifies into statute the current practice that is being used right now by the telecom companies and the law enforcement with two important addictions. During an ongoing emergency involving the risk of death or serious physical harm, it makes it clear that the law enforcement agency, not the telephone company, determines if there's an ongoing emergency or not. The way it stands right now, the telephone company has the opportunity to say, well, that's not really an emergency, but this turns it over to the police. And it also provides liability for those companies who are acting in good faith in response to the law enforcement agency request. And so those are the two major things that it does. There's a couple of things. There's been a lot of miscommunications around this bill, so I'll point out some of the things it doesn't do. It does not change the current standards or requirements for an emergency aid doctrine, which is clearly established in the State versus Gibson and is the controlling authority in the state of Alaska. 316 is intentionally limited, very limited in scope, and requires disclosure only the most current location of the phone. Requires law enforcement, only a law enforcement agency can request the device's location, and only in an ongoing emergency, which requires involves risk, death, or serious illness. This is one of those things that I hope we never get to use. This was brought to us by the Kelsey Smith Foundation, and Portia will go into that a little bit, but this was brought to us by a case in broad daylight in Kansas City. A young lady was abducted. They asked for the phone records to get the last location. Where was she? And the telephone company didn't do it. And 4 days later, they found her body along with her cell phone. Had the law enforcement agency been able to say, where is her last known location? There's a good chance that Kelsey Smith would be alive today. We want to never use this, but it's one of those things that if we need it, it is an emergency. It's a life or death situation. So therefore, I encourage the scrutiny and passage of this bill. It will save lives. And with any questions or anything else, I have my most able staff.
Are there any questions for the sponsor of the bill? I'll go ahead and just get started. My question that came up when I saw the bill was how, I guess, when you mentioned that they had asked before for the whereabouts of a specific wireless device, I guess why didn't they not release it? Was it because of privacy concerns? Was it because they don't have a process?
I think I can't answer. Maybe you can specifically in the Kelsey Smith specific case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Portia Samuels again, staff to Representative Johnson. So what happened in this particular case is that although there was video evidence of the abduction and the parents called law enforcement immediately that their daughter was missing, because even though that the law enforcement was making the request, the phone company person they talked to didn't know what to do, didn't know how to address it. They weren't sure if they should release it. And so they had delays and they're checking with legal, and it was almost 3.5 days when they finally said, okay, we can release this location information. This was also in 2007. Things have advanced quite a bit since then. So, matter of fact, the Kelsey Smith Act has passed in 31 states now. They just, Wisconsin just signed it into law in March of 2024. But that was the issue. It was more that the telephone person, the person they reached at the time, didn't know how to handle it, and they bungled through the process until they, I mean, she was only 20 miles away. And so she, by the time they found her body 3.5 days later, she had been raped and murdered.
Great. Thank you. Any further questions, Senator Klayman?
So I read sometimes in the news about how some of the cell phone companies that make the cell phones, like Apple, have all these privacy protections built in, and they're reluctant to violate some of these privacy provisions, which is, of course, in this instance, Apple. But this is about the telecommunications carrier who actually is providing the service. Does this really not conflict with whatever Apple or Google or whoever is the phone? Does that not conflict whatever things they may have about trying to protect privacy rights within the phone itself?
Thank you for the question, Mr. Chairman, Senator Klayman. Currently, it's the wireless provider makes the decision on whether to release the information. It is that completely up to them nationwide. Most of them have a process in place now. AT&T and the big T-Mobile, GCI, you know, when this first came to the attention of the office, we reached out to them, talked to them about what their current process is. They do have the authority to release that information. It is completely up to the wireless provider. This one area, which is very narrowly constructed, which would require them to release the information, is only during an ongoing emergency that meets the standard of exigency and where someone's life is in danger or bodily harm. So all those things have to be met, and then they will be required to release it, but only release that while the ongoing emergency is happening. And so we tried to have enough sideboards around it so that really this is only to save someone's life. If there is more time, law enforcement can go and get a warrant. They can get a search warrant if they need this information for something else that does not involve the emergency aid doctrine in the middle of an emergency.
Follow up. So as a practical matter, if Apple said, what the heck are you doing releasing these things that we think is private, the telecommunications company would say, this is our information. We get to do what we think is appropriate under the circumstances.
Through the chair, yes, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I might add, Representative Johnson, this is also only for the last location. This is not like a tracking thing as they were here, they were here, they were here. This is only the last location that the cell phone pinged off a tower, basically. So narrows it down to 2 to 3 mile area. And so it's not like you can track somebody going to the store or anything like that. It's just that one last known location.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Kawasaki. Thank you for bringing this bill forward. I've heard concerns from telecommunication companies how to verify if law enforcement is legitimate or if there's impersonations, because apparently there's been cases where domestic violence folks have impersonated a law enforcement officer, and it's a bad situation. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. This is Portia Samuels again for Representative Johnson through the chair. Senator Merrick, this did come up in discussion in the other body, and we amended the original bill to include a written request, so it has to be in writing, and either physical or electronic form, which is what they do right currently in Alaska, and it has to be from a law enforcement agency, and it has to be within their official duties, in their official business for doing this request, and it has to be during an ongoing emergency. If not, the individual who does that is in violation, and it's a Class A misdemeanor. So we did take those considerations on advisement and amended the bill to try to make it so that's very unlikely to happen.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. And just one other question for the maker. I mean, I'm guessing that you contacted some of these wireless carriers and other telecom folks. There's nobody online that's going to testify. So I just wanted to hear, maybe, is it easy to do? Is it something that's difficult to do as far as releasing information?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, again, we're doing it now. And all this does basically is define what an emergency is and who is able to request. So all the stuff we're doing now, in fact, most telecom companies have a designated, I don't want to say person because it's not something one person, but do a dedicated list of people who field these calls and are familiar with them. And in a lot of the police agencies, they have designated people as well to call. So it's almost like, Mr. Chairman, this is Representative Johnson. And so you know there's a relationship there, at least on paper, to document that. So we have had no negatives response from any telecom company, from the largest to the very smallest rural carrier in Alaska.
Great. Senator Wilkowski has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page one, it talks about the agency has to assert that there's a reasonable belief that the device is in possession of an individual who is in an ongoing emergency that involves the risk of death or serious physical harm. And then in page two, that section B there, it says an individual who violates the subsection is guilty of a Class A misdemeanor. Just so I'm clear, when it says subsection, is that referring to Section A also? So in other words, if a police officer doesn't have a reasonable basis to believe that it involves risk of death, would they be subject to a Class A misdemeanor?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, yes, that's my understanding. That Section B was added in to alleviate concerns that a bad actor or someone who might somehow request this information, and even though it's in writing, and even though it has to come from a law enforcement agency, that if that was misused, they could be charged with a Class A misdemeanor. Yes.
So, yeah, that was one question. Just, I guess, the definition of subsection, does that include Section A for the misdemeanor? So, in other words, if an officer doesn't have a reasonable basis to believe that it involves an ongoing emergency, they could still be convicted of or be subject to a Class A misdemeanor.
That's my understanding.
And then just on the issue of, let's see here. A and B are different subsections. Should instead of subsection that actually say section, an individual who violates this section be guilty of a Class A misdemeanor?
Thank you, Senator. I think that if I am not sure on that, so I think that it might need the clarification to say section, so we understand that it does include A of this section.
Thank you. Yeah, maybe just it's simple as deleting sub in front of in subsection might just clarify that.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I might, we're also not bill drafters.
Understand.
And they speak a language of their own.
I read it, and I'm just not entirely clear to me. So I'm just trying to, you know.
Also, if I might follow up to part of your question, if a police officer acting in bad faith would not only be a misdemeanor, would probably lose their job, and probably not be able to work as a police officer again for doing such a thing. And same goes with if an individual acting as a police officer would suffer the penalties of impersonating a police officer. So there's several safeguards in there that are already in statute.
And then another question for sure. And would this location information be admissible as evidence in a trial if they wouldn't otherwise meet the probable cause requirements for a warrant? Has there been any discussion about that?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Wilkowski, That is in the, what is happening right now would be the same in any kind of an emergency situation or exigent circumstances. If you retrieve evidence, it becomes part of the file and goes and is used in, as part of the case file. So as long as it is determined to be an emergency situation and you do not need, so there's a, if you don't need a warrant, then it can be used in court. Department of Public Safety online may be able to answer that more specifically, but even if it has nothing to do with cell phones or this case, if it's a entering into someone's home in an emergency situation and evidence is seized, I believe that becomes part of the case as long as the emergency aid exception was met.
Great, thank you. Did you want to hear from public safety? It looks like we also do have our invited testimony here too. Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you for presentation of the bill. I will go ahead and open up invited and public testimony. We have with, let's see, where are we? I think we have some invited testimony that just joined us online. We have Mr. Greg Smith, the executive director of the Kelsey Smith Foundation. Thank you for being here on Teams with us. He's on the back wall. If you could just state your name and your affiliation for the record. Can Greg Smith hear us?
His mic is muted.
It's muted on his side. We'll take a brief of these. Test, is Greg Smith available? Can you unmute yourself if you are? And if you just state your name and affiliation for the record, you're before the Senate State Affairs Committee. Take a brief at ease. Thank you. The Senate State Affairs Committee is back to order. I saw your flash on the screen that said you might be having difficulties with visual and audio, Mr. Smith. If you want to try again, or if we might be able to give you just a cell phone or a number directing you here instead, let me send you that number. It is 866-985-8066. Let me hold on just a sec. Let me brief it easy. Thank you. Okay, Mr. Smith. Okay, it's 844-586-9085, and then they will put you in the queue. We will be able to see you online, and we will open up testimony to you. And thank you for your patience, sir. We will now take a brief at ease until we get your call. Okay, the Senate State Affairs Committee is back to order. I'm told that we have Mr. Greg Smith as invited testimony with the Kelsey Smith Foundation. Mr. Smith, are you with us?
I am.
Great. We did it. If you could just state your name, your affiliation for the record, and welcome to the Senate State Affairs Committee.
My name is Greg Smith. I'm the executive director of the Kelsey Smith Foundation, and thank you so much for having me. I apologize for the issues I'm having with Teams. It just wouldn't let my camera work.
Great. Thanks for being here. Did you have a statement you'd like to make?
Yeah, basically, The Kelsey Smith Act is what we call this in Kansas. It was named after my daughter, Kelsey Smith, who was abducted from a department store and missing for 4 days. And it took a while to get her cell phone location information. Once that information got into the hands of law enforcement, her body was recovered in 45 minutes. The technology has changed drastically since 2007 when my daughter was kidnapped. And it's become a tool that law enforcement needs access to in order to save lives. This bill, I want to make sure that the committee mind frame is not looking at this as a way to get evidence of crimes or anything like that. This is strictly to find somebody that needs help. Whether that is a kidnapping situation like Kelsey was in, whether it's a medical situation, there are 31 states that have passed this law, language similar to what you all are working on. Wisconsin just passed it last month. And we get stories from all around the United States. I go around the country and I train law enforcement on wireless devices and exigent circumstances. And we hear how people are saved because law enforcement is able to get access to the location of a device warrantlessly when someone is in danger of physical harm or death. And that is the only thing that can be released is location. There are no pictures, no conversations, no text messages. This is strictly the location of the device and nothing else. We had a gentleman here in Kansas who had a stroke and was unable to speak, and all he could do was hit the quick dial on his phone to call home. And his wife figured out that something was going on, called law enforcement. They were able to do a geolocate on his phone. They found him. They were able to get him medical attention. And we have dozens of stories like that across the United States. The reason that this needs to be done is because federal law makes this a voluntary thing for the wireless providers. Under federal law, they can provide that information to law enforcement if the wireless provider believes that this is a life or death situation, but the wireless provider is the one making that decision. We spend hundreds of man hours, millions of dollars training law enforcement. I think it makes more sense for them to make that decision that we have an emergency situation here. Let the phone company know, the wireless company know, and they do the geolocate. So what the Kelsey Smith does is it simply says that instead of that being a discretionary act by a wireless provider, that it is now a mandatory act that when law enforcement has these conditions, that location needs to be given to law enforcement and nothing else. The other thing is, under federal law, any governmental entity can make that request for a locate on a wireless device. So you're talking under federal law, anybody from the president of the United States down to the dog catcher could make that. And if a wireless provider believes that this is an emergency situation, they're going to give them that information. The Kelsey Smith Act narrows that scope so that the only people that can get that information is law enforcement. And then use that as they need to locate that person to deliver life-saving services. So I appreciate the time with the committee. I'm happy to answer questions and go into federal case law and all that if that would be helpful. But I just appreciate the time, and I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Smith, for being online today. I guess my question would be just, can you kind of explain exactly what an exigent circumstance would be? And, the way the bill is written, it's drafted in such a way that says, doesn't use the word exigent, it just uses the word an emergency or something of some sorts involving risk of death or serious physical harm.
Absolutely. An exigent circumstance is basically that. It's an emergency. The definition that's used most often came from a federal court case, and it's those circumstances that would cause a reasonable person to believe that entry or other relevant prompt action is necessary to prevent physical harm to the officers or other persons, the destruction of relevant evidence, the escape of a suspect, or some other consequence improperly frustrating legitimate law enforcement efforts, which is just a really fancy legal way of saying this is an emergency. We don't have time to get a warrant to do this.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Smith. Are there further questions of the invited testimony today? Hearing and seeing none, we'll go ahead and close invited and public testimony. We have House Bill 316 before us. We're going to go ahead and set an amendment deadline for House Bill 316 for this Friday at noon. This Friday at 5 p.m. would be fine. House Bill 316, if we can get an amendment deadline by Friday, 5 p.m. to the Senate State Affairs Committee office, and we'll share those with the rest of the members of the committee. We will now go ahead and set House Bill 316 aside for a future hearing. Thank you very much, Representative, for being here today. We will now take up the last bill on today's agenda. The last bill is Senate Bill 229. Senate Bill 229 is sponsored by Senator Lukey Tobin. If Senator Tobin and staff to Senator Lukey Tobin would like to come, Mr. Louis Flora. We also do have two folks who have been invited testimony who are now currently on Teams. We will call on them shortly. We also do have online at least 15 people, and then some folks who are also in the room to testify. So we will try to limit the length of testimony. Did want to just say that you can also always send testimony to the Senate State Affairs Committee. It'll go to every member and will be part of the public record, and that is by emailing senatestateaffairs@aklag.gov. That is senatestateaffairs@aklag.gov. I'd like to welcome Senator Tobin to the bill, and if you could just introduce Senate Bill 229 to us.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Lukey Tobin, and I have the pleasure and privilege of representing Senate District I here in the Alaska Legislature. I'm going to just say the quiet thing out loud very quickly, which is I know for many this is a hot button topic, particularly here in the state, when we have legislation that seeks to help protect the public, prevent victimhood, and really focus in on the tools and resources we might be able to deploy to save lives. It sometimes comes at a dialogue that we need to have in the public space around Second Amendment rights. I just want to be frank. There is nothing in this bill that seeks to infringe on someone's Second Amendment rights. I have no interest in infringing on Alaskans' Second Amendment rights. What I do want to do is think about how that interacts with public safety. This is a bill about public health and public safety. And it is a dialogue, a conversation, a policy call that we need to make. And I know we need to have it in Alaska because we have the highest rate of youth suicide in our state. We have the highest rate of domestic violence in our state, and extreme risk protective orders have been proven tools to help reduce the impacts and hopefully save lives. Now, they're not the silver solution, by no means. They're not a bomb, but they are one resource that 21 other states have utilized to keep their citizens safe. 21 other states, the longest extreme risk protective order legislation has been in effect for over a decade. That particular law has not been enjoined. It hasn't been ruled unconstitutional, but it has kept people from hurting themselves and hurting others. And I just want to mention that I bring this bill before you for a variety of reasons. One, as you all know, I'm from rural Alaska. And many of my classmates who took their lives took them by use of a gun. And we've seen that this legislation in places like Indiana, and in other states have had up to a 13.5% reduction in suicide. There was someone who sent public testimony, which you can see and read in your packet, that said that 13.5%, if we put it into numbers for Alaskans, that would be 9 to 16 Alaskans that would be saved. Now, that seems like a small number, but that is the number of classmates that I lost in the 4 years that I went to high school in Nome Belts, as we sit in the room named after or named the school that I was going to is named after the person whose room we currently sit in. Now, I want to mention a few things, and we have many testifiers, so I don't want to take up too much of your time. But the legislation before you, I think, is a reasonable pathway forward. It provides protections, stipulations, guardrails. It will prevent folks from potentially using this in an abusive manner by trying to establish protective orders against folks over and over again. I think there is ample opportunity for folks to petition the courts if there is interest in taking their firearms from them. There's also resources for them to get their firearms back after a period of time. And the periods of times are outlined in the legislation before you. The last thing I want to say, and I think we've heard a lot from the previous bill about how we could potentially help the person who becomes a victim. And the bill before you is really about preventing people from becoming victims. As I've mentioned many times, I am married to a law enforcement officer. I am the stepdaughter of a state trooper who served here in the Juneau area. And I think about their roles in providing for our public safety. I think about the training that they received. I think about their own personal aptitudes. my spouse is one of those folks who will run toward the danger. He will put his life in front of yours to protect you. And I think about my role as a legislator, as a lawmaker, and I want to make sure that I am working on legislation that is going to save him. So, again, I want to be brief, as I know there's many people who are online and who are here in the room who want to testify, but a few things that I just want to note is that the 2022 Bipartisan Safer Communities Act set aside $750 million for state and local implementation of extreme risk protective orders. That means there's money available if we so choose to go after it to help us implement this legislation before you. That many of the extreme risk protective orders across the nation, as I mentioned, 21 other states have these particular laws on their books. They prevent between 100 to 100 folks from having access to a firearm that might result in their own death or the death of someone that we all love in their communities. There's much to be said about why we need this legislation, and I'm going to leave that to our testifiers who are online here in the room. But before we get to them, if it is such the committee's will, we can walk through a sectional analysis of the legislation before you.
Yeah, if we could just get maybe the highlighted sectional. It's a lot of words, but I think it's fairly brief in what each of those sections does. So if you'd like, Mr. Flora, if you'd like to state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you. My name is Louis Flora. I'm staff to Senator Lukey Gale Tobin. And I will just walk through the, I'll start on page 2, which is really where the new section of statute would begin, actually right at the bottom of page 1. Section 6 is creating the ex parte gun violence protective orders. And this would allow a police officer to request a ex parte gun violence protective order if the court finds that the petition establishes probable cause to believe the respondent is a dangerous individual, the court shall ex parte and without notice to the respondent issue a protective order. And this section defines how the order would be created. And Mr. Chair, I can briefly just summarize the gun violence protective orders would be a new section 1865-815, and that would allow a police officer to file a petition for a protective order against a respondent if they reasonably believe the respondent is a dangerous individual. Section 1865-825, modification of a gun violence protective order. It allows a police officer or the respondent to request modification of the gun violence protective order. And then we go down to 1865-830, dealing with surrender of firearms and ammunitions. Allows the court to order the respondent to temporarily surrender or sell all firearms and ammunition within 48 hours of receipt of the protective order. When the protective order is terminated or expires, the law enforcement agency shall notify the respondent that return of the firearms or ammunition to the respondent is available. Then the service of process is described in section 1865-835 and section 1865-840, notification of law enforcement agencies, where the court notifies the local law enforcement of the order so it can be enforced. And a new section 1865-845, we define household member for purposes of establishing a gun violence protective order. And then in section 7, we go back to the functions and powers of the district judge and magistrate, adds a conforming amendment to the existing powers of the district judges and magistrates to be able to administer the new gun violence emergency protective order. And then we have the indirect court rule amendments and conditional effects and the effective date section. And I apologize for the briefness of that, but we do also, we can stand for questions. I just want to be able to introduce a brief bio of our invited testifiers.
Got it. Thank you. Let's see, are there any questions for the sponsor of the bill before we go to invited testimony? And I actually have the biographies right here.
So. I have questions.
Oh, yep. Senator Bjorkman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 6, page 6. Starting line 20, the language here says that a law enforcement agency may sell firearms to a dealer. However, under subsection C, the law enforcement agency shall retain any firearms. Can you talk to me about how those work together? How are they? How is the court ordering the respondent to surrender to appropriate local law enforcement agency or sell? So the court is ordering someone to sell their firearms? I'm confused.
Yep. Go ahead. Senator Tobin?
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Bjorkman, Lukey Tobin for the record. So in this section of the legislation, the respondent has two options available to them. They can surrender their firearms or they can sell their firearms.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Hearing no further questions, we're going to go ahead to invited testimony. We have two people for invited testimony from the sponsor of the bill. The first one will go with Chris Carita. Chris Carita is an active duty detective with the Fort Lauderdale Police Department. He's currently assigned to the Threat Response Unit, where he investigates threats of mass gun violence and other cases requiring the use of extreme risk protective orders, or ERPOs. With more than 17 years of law enforcement experience, Mr. Carita has designed, implemented, and delivered role-specific ERPO training to road patrol supervisors and his fellow investigators. Thank you for being here, especially on East Coast time. Welcome to the Senate State Affairs Committee in Alaska.
Thank you so much for having me. Is the audio coming through?
Sure is.
Excellent. All right, so I'll start by saying good afternoon, and I'd like to thank Chairman Kawasaki and the members of the Senate State Affairs Committee for your time today. My name is Christopher Carita. I'm a 19-year law enforcement veteran in South Florida with 10 years in the Detective Bureau. And for the last 5 years of my career, in the wake of the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School shooting here in Broward County, I've been utilizing Florida's version of the Gun Violence Restraining Order as a police detective. I've used it successfully to intervene in crises, temporarily removing firearms from dangerous situations and preventing potential shootings and gun suicides. While doing this work, I earned my Master of Public Health at Johns Hopkins as a Bloomberg American Health Initiative Fellow with a focus in violence prevention. Today, I'm here to share my experience with you as a private citizen and the opinions I express are my own. I'd like to tell you about my first gun violence restraining order case in 2019. It was for a young man in his 20s who was struggling with growing anger, and he refused to tell anybody what was going on. When his mother brought him to a doctor to try to learn more, all the young man would share was that he had some people that he had to kill. He had no other violent history to speak of. Through our investigation, we also learned that he had already paid for an AK-47 pistol, which was now awaiting pickup at a local gun store. Based on his violent ideation and acquisition of firearms, we used a gun violence restraining order to block the purchase. He attempted to buy another firearm a month later, but the gun violence restraining order flagged that purchase again, and he was unable to obtain a firearm. Then, through the courts, he received services and we learned that he'd been getting robbed on his way home from work every Friday, and that he was going to use the AK-47 pistol to retaliate. When we received this case, he had not committed any crime and would have otherwise been able to legally purchase a firearm. Through use of a gun violence restraining order, he was denied firearm access, the crisis was able to pass, and he had the space to get the help he needed, preventing multiple potential firearm homicides and his own potential incarceration. He's back to work now. He's doing well, and he's helping support his family thanks to this intervention. That was my first gun violence restraining order case, and it was an early one in Florida. And I assumed that it had to be an anomaly, but it wasn't. Since then, I've used gun violence restraining orders to prevent people in crisis from taking their own lives. I've used GVROs to remove firearms from violent domestic situations, giving families the time and space they needed to heal, and the victims time and space to make themselves safe. I've used gun violence restraining orders to intervene in mass shooting threats at schools, workplaces, and in my community. Most of these cases are not contentious, and the respondents are ultimately grateful for the intervention, understanding that they needed the help. not to mention the gratitude of the respondents' families, who are so grateful that their loved one is alive and able to move forward. For the first 14 years of my career, I responded to more shootings, more firearm homicides, and firearm suicides than I care to remember. For the last 5 years of my career, I've been able to use gun violence restraining orders here in Florida to prevent those tragedies based on evidence through legal process and with the support of the community that these laws are designed to protect. Please support and pass SB 229 and give Alaskans the tool they need to save lives that would otherwise be lost to gun violence. I want to thank you again for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have about my experience with gun violence restraining orders, or the robust due process protections that are built into the law, or any other concern that you may have around these laws.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Carita. Do we have questions for the person testifying? I guess since you brought it up, just I think there's a lot of concerns about the due process part of this discussion. The definition of household members, for instance, could include is or was formerly in a substantive dating relationship with the respondent. So the question is, would an ex-girlfriend, what if she were to just say, hey, you know, this, I want that guy's guns and file this GVRO. I think that's what a lot of people might fear. So could you just sort of explain the process by which a law enforcement officer in Florida, I think it's a couple different types of people, can also request them in other areas. And I think that would put some comfort at ease to this committee.
Sure. So that's kind of twofold. So to take you through the basic process for Florida, I, as a law enforcement officer, would have to investigate the case. So I would typically respond out as the crisis is unfolding, investigate, and we'd have to move relatively quickly in most cases because we're trying to avert an imminent threat, whether that threat is to the respondent themselves or they're threatening to harm others. So to get the temporary restraining order, or the ex parte, I would have to swear out an affidavit and include any evidence that I had collected at that point. And I would then have to testify to a judge under oath to obtain the ex parte order. Now, that's no small thing, especially for a law enforcement officer. If I were to lie under oath or give false evidence in any way, shape, or form, that's not only the end of my career, but I'm looking at jail time. So it is no small bar for me to have to swear out an affidavit to these facts. So I'm not going to a judge unless I am sure that I have evidence to back them up. Then the process continues from there. Once the respondent is served with the order and any firearms are relinquished, we have to have a hearing within 2 weeks where the respondent gets to bring any evidence to the table that they feel is pertinent, and the judge conducts a hearing. I present all of my evidence, the respondent presents their side of the case, and the judge weighs the evidence and decides whether or not to implement a full risk protection order. So in Florida, it's a risk protection order. There's a gun violence restraining order there. In Florida, it could be up to a year with a minimum of 6 months. And the respondent has an opportunity in that year to contest the RPO and have it reheard. So there, within that process, I have to swear out an affidavit. I have to present evidence to a judge. A judge, a member of the judiciary, has to oversee whether or not the RPO is valid, and they issued the RPO based on my affidavit and the evidence. And then the respondent has multiple opportunities to present their side of the case and contest the evidence that I present, should they choose to do so. Now, all that being said, my experience, as I said in my statement, is that the majority of our cases are not contentious. In the majority of my gun violence restraining orders that I've carried out, I've obtained them with the cooperation of the respondent. By the time I've investigated, explained the situation, and made the person understand why I feel that a gun violence restraining order is necessary, more often than not, they cooperate and they stipulate to the order because they understand that they're in crisis and that they need help. And then we have a whole process to connect through the services with my agency. So going to your other question regarding the concerns around family members and giving false evidence. Well, again, a family member seeking a gun violence restraining order in Alaska would still have to swear out an affidavit in court and present evidence to a member of the judiciary under oath. The standard remains the same. If they were to do so and were intentionally deceitful, they'd be guilty of perjury as I would be here in Florida. That carries criminal penalty. And really more importantly is this is not really playing out. It hasn't played out that way with domestic violence restraining orders for the past 50 years. It is exceedingly rare for a victim of domestic violence or a previous partner to go through the trouble of swearing out under oath false evidence against their partner. We just don't see it playing out that way. There are far more efficient ways to get back at your partner than putting yourself in a position to be indicted for perjury.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate that answer, Mr. Carita. Are there any further questions? Just one more, just because you've got the experience in Florida. How long has Florida had the RPO? And then have you noticed, anecdotally, has there ever been a case where you've begun to investigate for an RPO and then decided that it was not warranted? Or how frequently does that happen?
So our agency actually uses them very judiciously. In Florida, violation of a risk protection order carries a felony penalty. It was passed in the wake of the Marjory Stoneman Douglas shooting. So the legislature here was more concerned with interpersonal violence and mass shootings. So they designed the law to have more teeth. It's a less therapeutic approach. So we use it less often. And we try to use other interventions. We actually look at risk protection orders as our last resort. We look for other avenues to mitigate a threat, to mitigate a problem before we go to the point of relieving somebody of their property to prevent a shooting or to prevent a suicide. So we seek other opportunities to intervene. And if none are available, this is the tool that we use.
Great. Thank you.
To answer your question, yes, we've had many cases where we've begun the investigation and found more appropriate ways to mitigate a problem, or found that after a vetting of the evidence, the threat was not what it appeared to be, whether it was a poor sense of humor or something of that nature.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Carita. We appreciate your time. Appreciate that you're, again, calling us from Florida. Let's see. We will go ahead next to our next invited testimony. We have Crystal Lopilato. She's the Senior Policy Counsel with Everytown for Gun Safety, where she focuses on gun violence prevention legislation for states in the Western region. As a member of Everytown's team of policy lawyers, Ms. Lopilato works to bring evidence-based policy solutions to state legislatures seeking to reduce gun violence in their communities. Welcome to the Senate State Affairs Committee.
Thank you so much. I should do the audio check as well. Is the audio working all right?
It sure is.
Thank you. Well, good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee, and thank you for your time today. My name is Crystal Lopilato, and I serve as Senior Policy Counsel with Everytown for Gun Safety. Together with Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America and Students Demand Action, we are the largest gun violence prevention organization in the country, with more than 10 million supporters, including mayors, veterans, survivors, parents, gun owners, and everyday Americans fighting for public safety measures that can help save lives. We're here today in support of SB 229, and we're very grateful to Senator Tobin for bringing forward this important bill. I also want to thank Chair Kawasaki for hearing the bill today. These are the building blocks of bringing about policy change that can make communities in Alaska safer from gun violence, and we appreciate your leadership. SB 229 would bring a new and important gun violence prevention tool to Alaska, the Gun Violence Protective Order, which, as you heard from Mr. Carita, sometimes called an extreme risk protection order or extreme risk law, carries a few names with it. But the thing to know is that when a person is in crisis and considering harming themselves or others, they often exhibit clear warning signs. Family members and law enforcement are usually the first people to see these signs. But in too many cases, they don't have the right tools to take preventative action once they've picked up those alarm signals. Extreme risk laws like SB 229 empower loved ones or law enforcement to intervene by asking a court to temporarily prevent someone in crisis from accessing firearms. These laws can help de-escalate emergency situations, and they're a critical tool for preventing tragedies before they occur. Like other states' extreme risk laws, SB 229 provides several different steps in a civil court proceeding, each with due process protections commensurate with the potential order that a judge could issue. As Senator Tobin mentioned, 21 states plus the District of Columbia have extreme risk laws like SB 229 on the books. These laws have been routinely upheld by the courts, which have found that the laws contain appropriate due process protections and do not violate the Second Amendment. This includes court rulings after the Supreme Court's Bruin decision in 2022 changed the analysis that applies to legal challenges brought under the Second Amendment. Extreme risk laws are not new or radical policy ideas. Indeed, as Senator Tobin mentioned also, the federal government has made funding specifically available for states to implement crisis intervention tools like SB 229 and even just launched a National Extreme Risk Protection Order Resource Center. Many states are investing increased attention to the robust implementation of their extreme risk laws because they're proven to save lives. And there's one other noteworthy detail in the bill which may complement some of Mr. Carita's testimony. SB 229 does include both law enforcement and household members as potential petitioners, and this provides a nice balance for how the tool may be used. As crisis responders and public safety officers, law enforcement is uniquely situated to identify people who may be at risk. But we also know that when someone is in crisis, loved ones are often the first to identify the signs. Some people don't want to involve law enforcement right away when, for example, a family member is suicidal or if they live in a remote area where they don't interact with local community law enforcement often. And a gun violence protective order is an important tool that can empower loved ones to seek help from a court to temporarily separate their loved one who's in crisis from firearms. That's why the vast majority of states that have enacted extreme risk laws do include that pathway for family or household members to seek the court's assistance in addition to law enforcement. And indeed, these laws have saved lives. Research has shown a decrease in firearm suicide rates in Connecticut and Indiana that is associated with their extreme risk protection order laws. Giving Alaskans the tool of a gun violence protective order could be particularly life-saving as firearm suicide rates in Alaska increased 49% from 2012 to 2021. And as of 2023, the state had the third highest rate of gun suicides in the entire country. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and we ask for your support on SB 229.
Great. Thank you very much, Ms. Lopilato. Are there questions? Okay, hearing and seeing none, I appreciate the both of you being online today to join us for invited testimony. We are now going to go ahead and open up public testimony. We have a number of folks who are online and in the room for public testimony. I will call people up based on when they were signed up. If you can state your name and your affiliation for the record. First person I will have up is Aobian Klein, and then immediately after her, we have somebody in the room, Diane Dislover. So if we can have Aobian come forward, online.
Thank you, Chair Kawasaki. This is Aobian Klein. Audio check, can you hear me?
We sure can. Thanks for being here today.
Excellent. Thank you. Again, good afternoon, Chair Kawasaki, Vice Chair Kleinman, honorable members of the committee. For the record, Aobian Klein, State Director for the NRA, in strong opposition to Senate Bill 229. Senate Bill 229's so-called red flag law is fatally flawed in a number of ways. First, red flag gun confiscation orders strip individuals of their constitutional rights without due process of law. In addition to the Second Amendment's right to keep and bear arms, the Constitution prohibits the deprivation of life, liberty, or property without due process of law under the 14th Amendment. This bill would allow the state to strip an individual's rights and their firearms without due process of law. The ex parte issuance of the protection orders under Senate Bill 229 raises significant concerns about this issue. Second, Senate Bill 229 is unnecessary. Alaska already has powerful civil commitment laws in place under AS 4730, 700, and 705. Senate Bill 229 seeks to improperly focus on the firearm rather than addressing the underlying dangerous individual. Third, Senate Bill 229 is a red herring based in emotion. There is no solid evidence to support red flag laws. An examination of available research on the effects of extreme risk protection orders conducted by the RAND Corporation and updated as recently as 2023 found no conclusive evidence that red flag laws reduced violent crime, mass shootings, suicide, or unintentional injuries and death. Instead, Senate Bill 229 sets forth dangerous confrontation situations between citizens and law enforcement. The Man Ray has examples of this in contrast to previous testimony. Finally, Senate Bill 229 invites abuse from a retaliatory personal relationship or from the political tool that it is for gun control advocates to utilize their innovative policy solution to disarm law-abiding Alaskans and does so without due process of law. This bill will lay the foundation for further gun control in Alaska, incentivized by federal funding and overreach. For these reasons, the NRA strongly opposes Senate Bill 229. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Abian. Are there questions? Okay, hearing and seeing none, we'll go ahead in the room. I forgot to say that we'd like people to keep their testimony for under two minutes. We also will take all public testimony online at senatestateaffairs@akleg.gov, senatestateaffairs@akleg.gov. Is Diane in here? Yeah, if you'd like to come forward, and immediately following you, we've got Marianne Clough. So welcome. If you could state your name and your affiliation for the record, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Diane DeSlover, and I am representing myself. Thank you for receiving testimony on Senate Bill 229, the vital extreme risk law aimed at preventing gun violence in Alaska. I am advocating on behalf of my five precious grandchildren who live here and attend public schools in Juneau. As I raised my three children here, I was glad that Juneau was such a safe community. But due to the current epidemic of gun violence in America, I know that my grandchildren are not safe. Mass shootings can and do happen anywhere. We know that a significant percentage of mass shooters exhibit signs of dangerous behavior before they initiate a deadly event. For family members or law enforcement officers who may be aware of those red flags, this bill would give them a way to act before it's too late. SB 229 would protect due process rights while providing a legal means to de-escalate and deter tragedy. 21 other states have such laws in place. Why wouldn't we increase the odds of saving the lives of children and of all our citizens? This past December, on the anniversary of the Sandy Hook tragedy, I reflected on what those children have taught us. It was as if one of them spoke to me personally and prompted the writing of this poem I share as I urge you to pass SB 229. From a Sandy Hook first grader. You've seen my face on the news, that missing front tooth grin, sparkly eyes, innocence that moves you. I don't get to play with my friends, give mom and dad a hug, or grow up anymore. My spirit is behind every phone call or letter insisting now is the time. You, not only that one over there or the one more qualified, it's you I ask to listen and use your voice to remember me in a way that really matters. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Diane. Appreciate your testimony. We now have Marianne Clough, and after her, Jan Caulfield. If you'd like to come forward, welcome to the State Affairs Committee.
Dear Honorable Members, Senator Kawasaki and members of the Alaska Senate State Affairs Committee, I'm sorry that a couple of your members had to leave. I'm Marianne Clough of Auk Bay, Alaska, and I'm representing myself. I've been an Alaskan resident for 41 years, have children and grandchildren living in this beautiful state who are constituents in Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Juneau. Thank you for taking the time to bring forth SB 229 for public testimony, a bill I fully support. Realizing your schedule is incredibly packed with the end of the session looming and the hundreds of bills that you see, I thank you for opening the dialogue to this extremely important topic, how to save lives with the epidemic of gun violence we face. We all know the staggering, horrific statistics of gun violence, and we need to find solutions. Even Florida, a Republican trifecta state, is among the 21 U.S. states that have adopted a red flag extreme risk protection order law. And while I was sitting here, I looked it up, and it was March of 2019 they adopted it, because that was one of the questions you asked, Chair. Why can't Alaska be included in these good statistics and do something to address gun violence, to help find solutions? You, as our legislators, have the ability to move the needle in a positive way for all Alaskans. And thank you for your hard work, your dedication to public service, and for opening up the dialogue with this hearing. However, this bill needs more than just a hearing. It needs a vote. And it is not too late. Please move SB 229 forward to address gun safety in the remaining days of the session. Thank you for listening to me.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony, Marianne. We now have Jen Caulfield, and after her, we will go off net.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. Appreciate that the three of you are here. I am sorry that Senator Klayman and Senator Wilikowski weren't able to stay, because there's a lot of testimony being offered in an important conversation, and it's the only hearing we've had on this bill or any bill related to gun safety this session, and so I certainly appreciate your time. I'm Jan Caulfield. I'm a 45-year resident of Alaska. I'm a parent, and I'm speaking in support of the bill. The bill would give caring family members and local law enforcement a due process tool, to temporarily remove firearms from a person in crisis showing signs of harming themselves or others. The Office of Veterans Affairs, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and other organizations recognize the importance of ensuring guns cannot be readily accessed when there is a mental health crisis. As you've heard, 21 states have adopted extreme risk laws because they recognize that these laws prevent firearm suicide, mass shootings, and school shootings, as you've heard in the invited testimony. I want to broaden my comments from this single bill to implore you, as Senator Tobin had also done, to enter into serious conversations about gun safety and gun harm in Alaska, and to be open to developing and supporting solutions that will save Alaskans' lives. We have the second highest rate of firearm suicide deaths, the fourth highest rate of gun deaths in the nation. Guns are the leading cause of death of Alaska children and teens. It is a serious public health crisis, and it is time for the legislature to act to prevent more gun deaths in our state, and as leaders to start these conversations about how we can address these statistics, save lives, and still make it fit for Alaska. I understand the concerns about gun rights. We have a gun in our home. I had venison in my salad yesterday. You know, it's something that we need to have conversations about how to make it work here, but not ignore the statistics and the loss of life that we're incurring every year. This session, there's an extreme risk bill to consider in both chambers, as well as HB 164, which is the Alaska Child Access and Secure Storage of Firearms Act. All of these bills are intended to lower the deaths of firearms in our state, especially saving the lives of children and vulnerable youth and adults that may be suffering a mental health crisis. So again, I implore you as legislators to take these statistics seriously and to work on solutions that would be effective and a good fit for our state. I ask you to move Senate Bill 229 forward. And please, next session, come back as leaders and work with your colleagues to meaningfully address, this public health crisis in our state through common sense gun safety laws that would work for Alaska. Thank you very much for your time and for this opportunity.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony. And I apologize that there are some members who have to leave. I recognize the time. But we do still have several folks who are online and in the room. I'd like to take all the public testimony if we could. And I also wanted to remind folks that you can also send testimony to the committee at Senate State Affairs at aklag.gov. And remember to note that it's the Senate bill that we're hearing is Senate Bill 229 relating to extreme risk protective orders. We'll next go online to Ms. Laura Fleming in Juneau, if you'd like to state your name and affiliation for the record.
Hi, this is Laura Fleming. Thank you, Chairman Kawasaki. Thank you, members of the Senate State Affairs Committee. I'm a resident of Juneau, former legislative staffer from back in the day, and a parent and grandparent. Thank you for holding a public hearing on Senate Bill 229 relating to gun violence protective orders. I strongly support this proposed legislation, and I urge you to think about adding Alaska to the long list of states where extreme risk protective orders have been enacted and are reducing the rates of death by gun. We won't be first. And we also don't want to be first in the rate of gun suicide deaths. Alaska is already in second place. And we don't want to be first in the rate of gun deaths. Alaska's currently in fourth place. Alaska's legislature could actually adopt laws that have been proved to reduce deaths. We don't have to sit on our hands here. Connecticut acted 25 years ago. Indiana acted 20 years ago and has documented a 7.5% drop in the gun suicide rate. Who in this room has not lost someone to suicide? It doesn't sound like a lot unless you happen to be a family member of the people that constitute the 7.5%. Vermont, New York, Washington, Minnesota, Michigan, New York, Rhode Island, Illinois, New Jersey, Virginia, Maryland, Delaware, Oregon, Nevada, Colorado, New Mexico, Hawaii, California, and Florida have all passed these laws enabling quick intervention. The issue has commanded support across the political spectrum. We don't want to be last in adopting laws to save lives, and we don't want to be first in deaths by gun. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Fleming. We will now move on to Wasilla. We have Mr. Patrick Martin. If you could state your name and affiliation for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair Kawasaki. My name is Patrick Martin. I'm from Wasilla. I'm calling in on behalf of myself. And I'm concerned about Senator Tobin's Bill SB 229. Her sponsor statement tells us that this is a common sense approach to helping people suffering from mental health crisis. Senator Tobin talks or links this unqualified mental health crisis with equally unqualified claims of high suicide, domestic violence, and sexual assault as justification for violating Alaskans' Second Amendment rights. The senator did not provide any evidence in the bill's record that there is, in fact, a mental health crisis. We're just supposed to accept that. Nor did she establish a link between lawful gun ownership and domestic violence, suicide, and sexual assault. Further, Senator Tobin has not established a link between violating Alaskans' Second Amendment rights and a direct reduction in the incidence of suicide, rape, and domestic violence in Alaska. Finally, Senator Tobin asserts that there's a Princeton University study that demonstrates that stricter gun laws resulted in lower gun deaths in 40 states over a 25-year period. But again, Senator Tobin did not enter that study into the record, So we're left with yet another ipsy-dixy statement of fact, when in actuality, what we're doing is we're applying an overly broad set of laws as another justification for violating Alaskans' rights to own and possess guns, to be free of unreasonable searches and seizures, and to enjoy the guarantees of due process of law before they lose their sacred rights, their liberties, and their property. Finally, if I could direct your attention to section 18.65.820, subsection C, beginning in line 10 of the bill, the court is to consider evidence that demonstrates the respondent has a history of stalking, brandishing firearms, violating existing protective orders, or threatening or attempting violence against the petitioner. But each one of those is a crime punishable by at least 1 year of imprisonment, meaning that if the court finds credible evidence of any of those crimes, then pursuing a law that would infringe on Alaskans' rights to own and possess firearms makes no sense whatsoever, but that the respondent should be immediately contacted and charged with the crimes that he's being accused of in the court. So it seems then that the purpose of SB 2229 is not actually to protect Alaskans from violent crimes, but rather to create a scheme by which Alaskans can be stripped of their rights to keep and bear arms, to be free of unreasonable searches and seizures, and to enjoy their guarantees to due process of law. And for these reasons and many more, I urge the committee to kill this bill, do not pass this, and put an end to these unconstitutional attempts to restrict and to violate Alaskans' Second Amendment rights.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Martin. I just wanted to say we may have that study. If we don't have that study, we will make sure that it's put online for the public record. And that's on our electronic bill system. Brief at ease. And I just wanted to clarify that the study that I think the gentleman was talking about is the one Princeton study, 1991 to 2016. If we will get a copy of that, we will at least put the abstract and possibly the entire document, depending on how large it is, onto the system so that the public can digest it. Let's go ahead and move on to the next person on the list, which is Mr. Rick McClure. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name and affiliation for the record, and you have 2 minutes.
Yes, I'm Rick McClure. I'm from Anchorage, and I'm representing Alaska Gun Rights. And I urge you to kill this bill. It is a direct violation of our Second and Fourth Amendment rights, U.S. Constitution, and also Article 1, Section 7, Article 1, Section 19 of the Alaska State Constitution. It's I've submitted for Alaska Gun Rights thousands of petitions that you'll see in the documents, and all those are against this red flag law. I appreciate if you would kill it. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. McClure, for being brief. We will now move on. We have Kitra Chastya. Hope I got that name correct. If you could state your name and your affiliation for the record, welcome.
Hi, my name is Kitra Chastya. Can you hear me?
We sure can. Thanks for being here.
Awesome. I hope it's all right that I'm chiming in on this. I'm actually have been planning on moving to Alaska. I myself am a domestic violence survivor, and I'm actually very opposed to red flag laws. I grew up in an abusive family that gaslit, and one of the things they did was try to convince myself as well as others that I was crazy. And it was very difficult to get through that process because they were very good at lying, and it took several weeks, and I got a full psych evaluation, proved that I was sane. Their response was the psychologist was a liar. It was quite a mess. I ended up getting help from the federal government to get away from them, but it is still something that if someone's going to commit a crime, having one more crime under their belt isn't going to matter. So for this to be labeled a crime for them to own a gun, or it's just not going to stop them. And all it's going to do is disarm law-abiding citizens such as myself. And I have gone through all the steps to be well-trained with my firearms, to just be able to have all the defense needs I need. And I have friends that are local law enforcement, and they understand my situation. And it would be a death sentence for me to move to any state with a red flag law. My dad was military. Yeah, they owned guns, but that did not stop the child molestation that happened. It's just not something that will actually protect victims. The best thing anyone can do for victims is teach them to be able to defend themselves. So I just want to put that out there for others like myself, and also to just, I guess, kind of let you know it's not a safe option for people in my position. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Kitra, for being online. Before we go on to the next person, I just want to note that there are 10 people who are online. There are two people who are in the room before we close. I guess I want to decide, because now we only have two members here. We could hold public testimony at a later time. We will, of course, leave public testimony open. We do have a hearing scheduled for Tuesday at 3:30. I'm just kind of curious. Let me take a brief at ease and talk with the sponsor of the bill. Thanks. Thank you for that brief at ease. What we're going to do is we're going to take the two people who are in line next, who are in the room here. And then what I'd like to do, I know there's folks who've been online for at least looks like a half hour or so. I wanted to say that there's, you don't know this, but there's only two of us left here. And if you want, I think it would really be good if you could speak to the rest of the members of the committee. So what I'd like to do is just keep public testimony open. You can always send public testimony to this committee at senatestateaffairs@akleg.gov. senatestateaffairs@akleg.gov. It will become part of the permanent record, and it will get scanned and saved into the document system. We will also keep public testimony open, and we will reopen public testimony on Thursday's meeting at 3:30 p.m. We'll start at 3:30. We'll have 10 minutes of motions, and then we'll have public testimony open. So 3:30 p.m. On Thursday the 2nd, I think it is. So with that, if you still are online, we're going to be ending testimony after I take these last two and have a closing by the senator. But I did want to keep public testimony open and reopen it on Thursday at 3:30 p.m. So I apologize, especially to my constituent whose name they spelled wrong. I'll give you a call after this. So with that, we'll go ahead and take the remaining two who are in the room who've been here for some time. We have Ms. Odette Edgar, followed by Lou Anne McVeigh. If you'd like to come forward, state your name and your affiliation for the record. Welcome to the committee.
Hello, my name is Odette Edgar. I live here in Juneau, and I represent myself. most of what I would like to say has been said better by other people, but I'm very much in support of the bill. And just wanted to remind folks that in Alaska, as elsewhere, suicides leave a gaping hole of pain for surviving family members and ripples through the larger community. And this seems to me like a very reasonable way to try to save some lives. So thank you very much for holding a hearing on this bill.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Edgar. Appreciate you being brief. Ms. Lou Anne McVeigh, if you'd like to come forward.
Hi, Chairman Kawasaki and Senator Merrick. I appreciate you having the time to hear what I have to say. I'm a retired school teacher from Douglas, and I grew up here in Juneau. And I think about families a lot. I mean, I've been as a school teacher, I've been around children and parents, and I have seen and heard lots of expressions of anger and frustration. I've heard children who are depressed, and being around all of the emotions that real people have in life, I think about the need for a bill like SB 229. Because I see how quickly anger, depression can escalate into the taking of a life, whether it's one's life or someone else's. And as a person who has a lot of family members here in Juneau, I know that I hear my children's expressions of frustration. I hear my parents who are in their 90s in the Pioneer Home, and it's all real. It's immediate. And if a person chooses to act on those intense emotions by taking a firearm, of which there are many around in our house, in our family, they're all locked up, but that's another topic. So if there is access to firearms, that allows a quick taking of one's life or another's life or a whole family's or a school's, as we all know what it can escalate into. If Alaska had an extreme risk law, we would be able to contact the authorities, and they could, through a court order, temporarily remove those guns until our loved one's emotional state becomes stable. Currently, we have no such law in Alaska, and I think it's a shame. I appreciate Senator Tobin's efforts to create one. There's no way, no legal way right now to protect our families from someone's potential harm to self or someone else. There's no way to convey the warning signs that we may have seen a loved one display at home to keep our families safe. So since Alaska has the second highest rate of gun suicides in the U.S., I strongly urge you to pass this bill and get it passed by the legislature as well. Thank you. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, Ms. McVeigh. I'd like to end here, but thank everybody who testified, including the two folks who were invited testimony. I apologize to the folks who may have been on for a while. I know a lot of folks, we had folks from Fairbanks, Anchorage, Palmer, who all were online. We will take public testimony on this bill on Thursday. With all the members here, so they'll all be able to hear you. But I do appreciate, you can also send your email to senatestateaffairs@akleg.gov, senatestateaffairs@akleg.gov. That testimony will be put into the permanent record. If Senator Tobin, if you'd like to join us for a closing before we end the meeting today. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you again, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Lukey Tobin, Senator for Senate District I. I want to thank you both for taking some time to hear about why this reasonable legislation that does protect due process is put before you. And again, as I've mentioned before, I grew up in rural Alaska. We have fire homes in my home in Nome, and we have firearms in my home in Anchorage, as my husband is a law enforcement officer. This is not about infringing upon folks' Second Amendment rights. This is about having a dialogue and discussion about how we protect the lives of Alaskans and how we empower our courts and empower our law enforcement before something terrible happens. I was getting ready for this bill hearing, and as I was walking out the door, my colleague reminded me that right now, in this very moment, someone is thinking about taking their life with a gun. Right now, someone is thinking about hurting someone with a gun. There is opportunity for us to really have a good dialogue and discussion about what we could do to prevent that. I hope we have further discussions about SB 229 now and over interim, and think about what we can do as legislators to protect Alaskans' lives. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Tobin. I appreciate you bringing this bill forward and appreciate all the folks who were able to testify. I just wanted to remind folks that testimony will remain open. We will hear this bill once again on Thursday. And if you are cut short, we might have more time at that point and more members here. We will go ahead and adjourn the meeting of the Senate State Affairs Committee right now. On Thursday, we will hear House Bill 146 regarding fireworks by request of the governor. House Bill 81, we have a committee substitute that is lien and transfer on death titling by Representative Rauscher. House Bill 129 relating to elections by Representative Vance, and any other bills previously heard or scheduled. In addition, we will immediately open up public testimony again on Senate Bill 229, the Extreme Risk Protection Order. I want to go ahead and thank everybody who's here. Thank everybody who testified. Thank everybody who's online. The meeting of the Senate State Affairs Committee is now adjourned at 5:23 p.m.